From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Newhart, the psychologist, the innkeeper, the stand-up comic, the man. Friday, Bob Newhart is reviving some of his classic stand-up act at Carnegie Hall. Two of his sitcoms are currently on Nick at Night. We'll talk with him about his stand-up days, his sitcoms, and his own not very tempestuous life. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Pennsylvania, the new release by the 20-year-old group Peer Ubu, and book critic Maureen Corrigan suggests some good reads for your summer vacation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Yeah, I see how bad this guy was just about to get you to feel in clubs. And I've been alone with badgers, making a wonderful with monsters, and it's me alone in the middle. Now it's the line, some mirrors blue in the skies, grim and fugitive, being on the fast, the ski world first night.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Friday night, my guest Bob Newhart will revive some of the stand-up comedy act that first made him famous in the early 60s. He'll perform at Carnegie Hall as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival. With the help of Nick at Night, several generations have become Newhart fans. You can still see him playing psychologist Dr. Bob Hartley on The Bob Newhart Show, which had its initial run from 1972 to 78. Nick at Night also runs The Newhart Show, which ran from 82 to 90, in which he played Vermont innkeeper Dick Loudon. His latest series, George and Leo, was just canceled by CBS. Before we meet Bob Newhart, let's listen to an excerpt of his first comedy album, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, recorded in 1960, in which he does the kind of one-sided phone conversation that became a trademark. The premise of this phone call is, what if Abe Lincoln was being advised by a Madison Avenue advertising executive?
Hi, Abe, sweetheart, how are you again? How's Gettysburg? Sort of a drag, huh? Well, Abe, you know them small Pennsylvania towns. You seen one, you seen them all. Right. Listen, Abe, I got the note. What's the problem? You're thinking of shaving it off. Abe, don't you see that's part of the image? Right, with the shawl and the stovepipe at the string tie. You don't have the shawl. Where's the shawl, Abe? You left it in Washington. What are you wearing, Abe? A sort of cardigan? Abe, don't you see that doesn't fit with the string tie and the beard? Abe, would you leave the beard on and get the shawl, huh? Now, what's this about Grant? You're getting a lot of complaints on Grant's drinking, huh? Abe, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't see the problem. I mean, you knew he was a lush when you pointed him. You see that? You're gag writers. Yeah, you're gag writers. You want to come back with something funny, huh? Maybe an anecdote about a town drunk. Well, I can't promise anything, Abe. I'll get him working on it. All right, Abe, you got the speech. Abe, you haven't changed the speech, have you? Abe, what do you change the speeches for? A couple minor changes, I'll bet. All right, what are they? You what? You typed it. Abe, how many times have we told you on the backs of envelopes? I understand it's harder to read that way, Abe, but it looks like you wrote it on the train coming down. Abe, could you do this? Could you memorize it and then put it on the backs of the envelopes? You're getting a lot of play in the press on that. How are the envelopes holding up? You could stand another box. All right, I'll
Now, how did you come up with the one-sided phone call bit?
Well, you know, I'm credited with that, and I certainly didn't invent the form. One of the first records ever was a thing called Cohen on the Telephone. And then, of course, George Jessel used to do phone calls to his mother, and then Shelley Berman did a lot of one-sided conversations. Mike and Lane did two-sided conversations, but they were telephone conversations. There are some routines that lend themselves to the telephone, and I think what happens is the audience, the people listening to it, it makes it a hot medium in Marshall McLuhan's words, because they're involved. They're supplying something. They're not just sitting back and saying, "Oh, that's funny. Oh, that's funny." They're supplying the other end of the conversation. I belong to a country club out here, and George Scott belongs to it. And he asked me one time. He said, in that kind of gruff voice of his, he said, "Let me ask you something. How do you do those? How do you do those telephone conversations?" And I said, "Well, George, I just, I ask a question, and then I wait long enough for the person on the other end to answer it, and then I start talking again." He said, that's amazing. It's absolutely amazing." And I thought to myself, "No, George, Patton is amazing. this is just a telephone conversation. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to do it. That's the only way you can do it."
Bob Newhart is my guest. Now, you're Catholic, and when you were coming of age as a comic, I think a lot of the comics were Jewish comics who were getting their start in the Catskill Mountains, which was a largely Jewish resort area. And I'm wondering if you ever felt that ethnic comics had a built-in constituency, i.e. people of their ethnic group. And did you feel like you had that kind of, because there was no borscht belt for you.
No.
Did you play the borscht belt at all?
No, I never have.
Right.
The Catskills, no.
Right. So did you feel like that...
I played the Poconos. That's as close as I ever came to the
right.
Catskills.
Okay. Did you feel like you were missing out on something, not being identified as an ethnic comic?
Well, humor, I think, at that time was very regional, as I recall. It was... I remember Phil Foster doing routines about the Brooklyn Dodgers. And then television came along, and you had to make your humor continental. You couldn't make it regional anymore. It had to be... You had to find ways of not making it regional, is what I'm trying to say. After some time, I realized that a lot of my friends that... a lot of the comics are Jewish that I know, and they would refer to their Jewishness. And then I began referring to my Catholicism and what it's like to grow up as a Catholic, and began to realize how funny it is in many ways to grow up. It gives you a chance to kind of stand back and look at it and find the humor in it.
What did you find funny about your Catholic upbringing?
Well, for instance, I said what the difference between Catholics and other religions is basically we have confession, and non-Catholics don't understand how you go in this little dark room and tell another human being like terrible things you've done during the week. But if you're raised Catholic, there are certain tricks you learn about going to confession, like you... you sit in the very last pew, and you watch the two lines move into the confessional, and whichever line moves the fastest, that's the one you get in, because that priest wants to get out of there. And I remember the first time I did that, and it got a big reaction from the audience, and I realized, oh, I'm not the only one who did that.
You kind of treat it as if it was a long line at the supermarket instead of the confessional. Can you remember for us what the venues?
Yes. That's interesting, because it does suggest they might have a confessional like 10 sins or less.
The swift moving line.
I just thought of that.
That's good. Oh, can you recall for us what your early venues were like? What the smaller clubs, if there were such things at the time, and what Reno and Vegas were like when you started doing them in the 60s?
Oh, wow. There were clubs. They weren't comedy clubs per se, much as they'd be referred to today as, with just one comic after another getting up and doing 5 minutes. There was they were folk music clubs, places like Mr. Kelly's in Chicago and the Hungry Eye in San Francisco and the Crescendo in Los Angeles. And you'd get up and do half hour, 35 minutes, and then this folk group would come on and sing, and then a guy would play the banjo and do protest songs, and then you'd be on again.
And what about Vegas?
Vegas was fun. It was a chance to, you'd be there for a month. So it was a chance for the family to come up and be with you on the weekends and have some kind of normalcy to your life. As much as walking on a stage twice a night and trying to make people laugh is normal, you know. But that would be the... And there was a camaraderie among Vegas people that still exists. I still see Steve and Edie and Shecky Green and Dick Martin and Don Rickles and these are all friendships that were developed in Vegas.
Well, you know, you mentioned Don Rickles. I know you and he are, or at least were, best friends. And it seems like such an incongruous pairing because, you know, I mean, the last thing in the world you would do is insult people on stage. And Don Rickles is like Mr. Insult Comic. Your temperaments couldn't seem more opposite.
Well, I don't know.
Are you really nasty off the stage? And is he really nice?
Oh, he's very nice. I'm probably nastier off the stage than I appear, and he's nicer than he appears. Mm-hmm. But we feed each other. We both our wives enjoy each other's company, and we enjoy each other's company. And we go away on vacation, and we're together for 2 or 3 weeks, and we have laughs. We just have a good time. It's something I wish everybody could have. A friend such as the Rickles.
Where do you guys go on vacation? Not to Vegas.
Oh, no. That would be, that'd be a working vacation.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be what they call it, busman's holiday. The last trip we made, we went to Southeast Asia. We went to, we flew to Singapore and got aboard a liner and, made stops in Bangkok and South Vietnam and North Vietnam and then Hong Kong, and then we flew to Beijing in China and then flew home from Beijing. And it was a wonderful, wonderful trip. It was we went up the Saigon River, and it's very narrow at points, they have a pilot who was a local Vietnamese who knows the river very well, and we happened to be up in the where you know the captain invited us up, and this Vietnamese was yelling out, barking out, 2 degree right, 4 degree right, 2 degree right, 2 degree left, 4 degree that kind of thing, and. Because at times you could almost hit the bottom of the Saigon River because it was such a large cruise ship. And the captain said, "You see that man who's the pilot?" I said, "Yes." He said, "He's the third most highly decorated Viet Cong in Vietnam." And that was weird. That was a weird sensation of. It was approximately, I think it was just about 20 years, almost to the day that the Vietnamese War ended. It was chilling. And you realize especially going up the Saigon River, how impossible that war was to win. The jungles were so dense that someone could be 4 feet away from you and you wouldn't have the slightest idea. And it was our country. You wonder, what were we thinking?
You know, I'm wondering, I'm thinking, like, how odd it would have been if, like, say I were a journalist in Vietnam, and there was Don Rickles and Bob Newhart sailing up the river. I thought I was hallucinating or something. Did you run into any people who did a real double take seeing you and he will go by?
Met a man. I'm confused now whether it was China or Vietnam. But anyway, they kind of knew who I was, but they didn't know who Don was. And I think that upset him. And I derived a great deal of satisfaction from it. But that has happened before. We traveled in Europe, and of course they don't really know either of us. And they certainly don't know what to make of Don. Here's this loud American who's just yelling things at people and insulting them.
Does he do that when he's touring?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, sure. And so they don't quite know what to make of Don when we're on vacation.
I mean, does he do that as shtick, or is that just the way he treats people?
He can't help it. He sees things, and he makes observations that are just, they're scary at times, that they're so they're so right, you know?
My guest is Bob Newhart. He's performing his stand-up act Friday night at Carnegie Hall as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bob Newhart. I have another question about when you started doing stand-up comedy. You started doing stand-up during the era I've come to think of as the "you dirty rat" era, because every stand-up comic was compelled to do impersonations of James Cagney. And they also were required to do impersonations of Armstrong and Bogart, and you did some of those yourself.
I was never much of a impersonator. Comics kind of have an ear for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never real good at it. What I found was interesting, and it certainly wasn't planned in any way, but the people I mentioned, Mike and Elaine and Shelley Byrne and myself and Johnny Winters and Lenny Bruce, it was a different kind of comedy than had preceded it. What had preceded it was material that could be stolen. In other words, "Take My Wife, Please."
Jokes.
Or jokes. I burn a hole in the coat. You like this jacket? It's a beautiful jacket. I got 8 pairs of pants with it. With my luck, I'll burn a hole in the coat. You know, well, anybody could deliver that line. It wasn't personalized at all, but. Without realizing it, because I certainly wasn't aware of it. It's only in hindsight that I'm aware of it. You couldn't steal a Mike and Elaine routine or a Shelley Berman routine or a Bob Newhart routine or Johnny Winters routine. They would say, oh, that sounds like Johnny Winters. And so it became, it was just shift in American comedy that just happened. And I think why it happened was our audience was largely college kids, and they didn't have mother-in-laws, so mother-in-law jokes didn't mean anything to
them.
Thank
goodness.
You know? and so to that extent, the humor that was being done in nightclubs was irrelevant to them, and it was also very expensive. Nightclubs had a cover charge, and it was very expensive to go to a nightclub, and they didn't have the money, obviously. So they would buy a record and get some pizza and some beer, and they'd all sit around and listen to one of us, and that was their nightclub, and I think that's what happened.
Right, you had an onstage persona, like you said, it wasn't just jokes; it was a whole character that was telling these stories.
Exactly, and it as in Abe Lincoln, which you played. This is, he's despicable, this man. Really, his disdain for...
the ad man you're talking about.
Yeah, the ad man, the spinmeisters, his disdain for the intelligence of the people is reprehensible, you know? Those were the people I liked to make fun of, the heavies in our life.
Bob Newhart is my guest. Let me ask you about the first sitcom that you did, the first Newhart show. You played a psychiatrist. It's common now to have stand-up comics with their own sitcoms. In fact, it's almost obligatory. right. What was it like when you were a stand-up comic, having a sitcom built around you?
Well, it was paternalistic, really, because my manager, and my manager still is Arthur Price, and he and Mary Tyler Moore and Grant Tinker formed MTM Productions. And with the success of Mary's show, he came to me and he said, would you like to do a sitcom? And I said, yeah, I would, because it would keep me home, it keep me off the road, and I could spend some time with the family, which was very important. So we then went about trying to come up with a sitcom. We started out with what occupation is he? First of all, he's married, right? Okay, he's married, and I insisted on that we not have children, that we not have precocious children, because I hated that. Those kind of shows that where the kids are always bailing the dumb father out of some scrape he's gotten himself into, you know, and we love you, Daddy. Daddy's an idiot, but we do love you. And resolved I wasn't going to do that kind of show. And so then we started looking for occupations, and I sat down with Lorenzo Music and Dave Davis, who I'd worked with before, who had been writers on the Mary Tyler Moore show, and I knew Lorenzo from the Smothers Brothers show, and he said, "Well, you know, Bob is—he's a listener. He's like a reactor. He reacts to people. What occupation would lend itself to somebody who listens?" And they said, "Well, how about a psychiatrist?" So they came to me and said, "What about a psychiatrist?" I said, "Well, let's make him a psychologist, because I think a psychologist tends to deal with less severely disturbed people." And I didn't want to be making fun of severely disturbed people. I didn't want to be making fun of people with multiple personalities or schizophrenia or any
right.
of that stuff.
Suicidal depression, yeah.
Yes.
Right. Mr. Carlin.
Mr. Yeah. Carlin actually was worse at the end of 6 years than he was when he originally came to me. So he has a class action suit against me, I think, as do most of my group.
Bob Newhart. He'll perform his stand-up act Friday night at Carnegie Hall. He'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hello?
Coming up, Bob Newhart chooses his favorite episode of The Bob Newhart Show. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest CD by Pere Ubu, and book critic Maureen Corrigan suggests some good reads for your summer vacation.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bob Newhart. He's performing his stand-up act Friday night at Carnegie Hall as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival. When we left off, we were talking about the Bob Newhart show in which he played psychologist Bob Hartley. Here's a scene in which Bob and his wife Emily, played by Suzanne Plachette, have just found out their respective IQ scores.
You know, Bob, ever since you took that IQ test, you've been sitting around acting petulant.
What do you mean by that?
Petulant means suddenly irritated by the trivial.
Emily, I know what petulant means. You don't have to talk down to me just because I'm not as intelligent as you are.
Bob, you are intelligent.
Well, maybe I am, Emily, but ever since I found out what our IQs are, I think it's affecting our marriage.
What do you mean by that?
Marriage is a wedding between
two... Oh, Bob, I know what marriage means. What's it got to do with us? We've got a perfect marriage.
Emily, a perfect marriage is where the husband and the wife have the same IQ.
Bob, it is not important.
Next to perfect is where the husband's is higher than the wife.
Bob, forget it.
Third is where the wife is 1 point higher than the husband.
Please, Bob.
And the fourth, which is us, which is the worst, is where the wife is 151 and the husband is 129, which is a difference of,
22.
Let's get back to our interview with Bob Newhart. Now, part of your persona in the Newhart show was, you know, he was the straight-laced, middle-of-the-road guy who was kind of dull.
Okay.
Right? How did the writers come up with that aspect of it? A lot of surrounded by a lot of nutty, eccentric people, but he was kind of dull.
Well, part of the success of Newhart was we tried to isolate what made the Bob Newhart show work. And what seemed to make part of the Bob Newhart show, at least the working environment of the Bob Newhart show, the psychologist's office, was you had to have a situation where no matter how outrageous the statement was made by one of the patients, You couldn't react to it. You couldn't say, "That's the craziest thing I've ever heard, Mr. Carlin." You know, you'd have to say. I remember one time I said, "How did this week go?" He said, "It went very well." He said, "Oh, Saturday I was possessed by the devil," and I think my line was, "Okay, you want to go with that, Mr. Carlin?" You know, I couldn't say you were what. So we tried to find those elements and. In Newhart, and we found them in the guests. No matter how unreasonable the guests were, you still had to kind of say, "Certainly, sir. Certainly, I'll send the maid up to the room right away."
Do you have a favorite episode from the first Newhart show?
I have several. There's one that kind of summed up comedy to me. I had an African-American insurance salesman came in, and he was very tall and muscular, and he wore the Djibouti, and he had a black Great Dane that he called Whitey. And he came to me, and he said, "I don't seem to be able to sell insurance policies." And I said, "Well, it has nothing to do with your personality. It's just that you kind of scare people, you know." And he said, "Well, thank you very much." So then we leave my office, and he said, "Is the men's room?" And I pointed out just down the hall, and he let the Great Dane stay there. So with that, Jerry comes out, and he comes over to me, and we start talking, and with the black gentleman comes back in, and he says, "Sit, Whitey." And with that, Jerry sits right on the reception desk, you know. And it got a huge laugh. And to me, it summed up what comedy does. It diffuses tensions in many areas. It gives you distance so that you can stand back and laugh at things. But there were a lot of Bob Newhart shows and Newhart shows that I loved. I love one that Julia sang. We did a telethon and had nothing to do with me. I mean, I was the host of the telethon, but Julia...
This is on the Vermont show.
Yeah, Julia Duffy Stephanie. Everybody was doing something on the telethon to try to raise money. I forget what the cause was. And Julia did an up-tempo Old Man River. And it's one of the funniest things to this day that I've ever seen. It was hysterical. It was, I mean, her lack of understanding of the lyrics was incredible.
Well, that was a great show, too, the show in which you played an innkeeper in Vermont, and who also, at least for several years, hosted a local TV show called Today, in which Michael, your producer, would either book you the most ludicrous or just incredibly boring guests.
That's
and I love the look on your face when you were interviewing somebody, just outrageously dull, you know, doing an outrageously pointless interview.
We had Estelle Getty on one show before the Golden Girls, and she was a librarian who had come up with a new Dewey Decimal System. and Michael was trying to jazz it up. He had all kinds of things going in the background to kind of jazz it up.
You know, your shows have been rerun a lot on Nick at Night, and I think there was one, I don't know, 24 or 48-hour period when they did a whole Bob-a-thon. They were bringing on, I guess, a new series of yours, a new and rerun series of yours, and to introduce it and celebrate it, there was just hour after hour of continuous Newhart programs. What was that like for you?
Well, that's a tribute to the cast and to the writing, that the writing is still valid. And I had something to do with that. I told the writers, don't put any Gerald Ford jokes, you know, because this is going to be rerun and rerun and rerun, and we're going to look silly, you know. Because I knew then that it would go into syndication and people would be watching it. And we tried to get away from being trendy, and for that reason. And it holds up. The material holds up, which is largely a tribute to the writing.
The lapels and the sideburns don't hold up.
That's the only thing I know.
You wear a lot of plaid also.
Oh yeah.
No, well, see, whose idea was all the plaid?
My dresser was colorblind.
Are you kidding?
Name was Ralph, yeah. And he was such a nice guy, we didn't want to say anything, but...
Oh, that's so Newhart.
My wife...
that is like quintessential Newhart.
My wife would come in, and I'd be ready to go out, and I'm not good with colors either, so she would say, oh, my God, you're kidding. And I said, what? She said, oh, take the jacket off. It doesn't even come close to going with the shirt.
That's funny.
But, you know, of all careers to choose when you're colorblind, I mean, wardrobe seems like the last one.
Yeah, you think somebody might have said something about it at the studio, or...
I remember reading an article in a paper about a one-eyed bullfighter in... again, we get back to material coming out of the papers. A one-eyed bullfighter in Spain who was reapplying for license to fight the bulls. And... it occurred to me then that if there is one occupation where you really want to have two good eyes, I think bullfighting would be right up toward the top, you know? I mean, of all professions to choose.
When you started on television, it was in the days when there were three networks and in many cities a couple of, you know, syndicated kind of channels, but... You know, when a show was popular, everybody seemed to watch it. And television has just become such a different experience now because there's so many channels. Do you feel the difference?
Well, of course, we used to get shares like 42, 43 shares.
It's an enormous
I mean, you know,
amount of people.
Those are Super Bowl shares now.
Exactly.
Because there was no competition. I just found out the engineer told me that... that I was the I Love Lucy of the United Arab Emirates, which I had never known. He said, but they showed the Bob Newhart show in the United Arab Emirates, and people would go home early from work to see it. I never knew I was a hit in the Middle East.
Huh. The first Newhart show was on Saturday night, right after Mary Tyler Moore.
It was All in the Family, MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, us, and Carol Burnett.
Was Saturday night a good time? I remember, you know, like when I didn't have something to do, when I was feeling really bad about it. At least I could stay home and watch you and Mary Tyler Moore, so it wasn't a total loss.
Well, it was a time shift. People stayed home Saturday because of that lineup, as they stay home Thursday because of NBC's Thursdays. And it used to be, I think Monday was Lucy, I think, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
I think Monday, and then I think Burl was Tuesday. And so it shifted. That was must-see Saturday.
When I think of the Newhart character in your shows from the 70s and the 80s, I think of somebody who stammers a lot, not because he's unsure of what he feels, but because he can't really afford to reveal what he really feels, because it might be a little harsh or it might be a little too something. So there's this constant kind of like stammering to just, you know, cover up and to try to kind of package in a better way what it is that he's really thinking or feeling. Does that work for you?
Well, that's interesting, because the stammer is real. I didn't invent the stammer. I remember in the first year of Newhart, we were doing an episode, and it was running long. And one of the producers came up to me and said, "Can you run some of the words together? Because the show is really spreading." And I said, "Look, this stammer got me a home in Beverly Hills, and I'm not about to change it. So you better get some words out of the script." No, it isn't. It isn't an affectation. It's a way I speak. Although I do, I know what you're saying. It does help to get you over an uncomfortable moment. I think of him as a nice person who doesn't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Right.
But at the same time, has difficulty saying, you know, what he means.
So listen, you're performing in New York at Carnegie Hall as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival on June 12th. What kind of material will you be doing, and what will be the mix of old and new material, you know, classic Newhart and new Newhart?
Probably I'll do one or two of the old record routines, because I think people show up for that. And then the rest of it is conversational. It's observational. What it's like being Catholic. What it's like not liking to fly. What a strange place we inhabit.
I'll say.
This planet.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Terry.
Very much. Bob Newhart will perform his stand-up act at Carnegie Hall Friday night. Here's an excerpt of part of his 1995 video of his button-down concert. This is The School for Rude Bus Drivers.
So what we're going to do, we're going to take one of the students, Johnson, yeah, you want to get in the bus, and Miss Selkirk, yeah, you want to get back to your marks, and we're going to present you with situations you'll very often encounter on your buses. All right, Johnson, yeah, pull your bus in. All right, discharge your passengers. Now, out of the rearview mirror, you notice this old woman running for the bus. Yeah, you want to start running, Mrs. Selkirk? Let's see how Johnson handles this. You're pulling out much too fast, Johnson. Hold it. Yeah, she gave up halfway up on the block that time. Yeah. No, what you want to do is just kind of gradually ease out, you know, and you're kind of always holding out the hope they can catch up with the bus, you know what I mean? Now, another thing you have to watch, a lot of these older women, they'll run at three-quarter speed, and they'll put on a final burst and catch up with a bus. So. All right, Johnson, let's try another one. Graham, you want to try your hand, the same problem? Yeah, you want to get back to your marks, Mrs. Selkirk? Okay, same situation. You pull in, discharge your passengers. All right, you want to start running, Mrs. Selkirk? Let's see how Graham handles this. Did you see how he slammed the door right in her face that time? That's called your perfect pullout. And
coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Pere Ubu's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Pere Ubu formed in Cleveland in 1975 and anticipated much of the far more publicized British and New York punk rock, with its fractured melodies and vocals sung or spoken in ordinary voices. In the case of Pere Ubu, the voices were those of Peter Lofner, who died in 1977, and David Thomas, who has remained the most recognizable sound of Pere Ubu through numerous personnel changes. Pere Ubu's latest, its 11th studio recording, is called Pennsylvania. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Between Vegas and Los Angeles, the world and his brother too, they're down on the news, howling at the moon.
Pere Ubu's Pennsylvania has been out for a couple of months now and has caused nary a ripple in the commercial tide pool of rock and roll. On one level, there's no reason why it should. For much of what comprises the cult of Ubu, the album doesn't break new ground. It's another collection of careful clatter, intentionally monotonous beats and vocals. But on another level, I think Pennsylvania may prove to be the most overlooked album of the year if you hear its restatement of the usual Ubu strategies as being played with fresh intensity and earnestness. Nowhere is this more clear than on the leadoff cut, a song called Woolly Bully that has nothing to do with Sam the Sham and the Pharaoh's 1960s hit.
There's a diner out on Route 322 in western Pennsylvania. I spent my life there one afternoon. I can't get that stretch of road out of my head. I hear it when I'm taking a shower, reading the paper. I'd look up and see it across the valley. They tore down the starlight down at the end of the road and built a big daisy in the blocks of view. But I know that road's still there. I can feel it wherever I go, whatever I'm doing.
Woolly Bully is, I think, an almost literally stunning song. That is, whenever I listen to it, I'm transfixed by David Thomas's narrative, which is like something out of a David Lynch film like Blue Velvet or Lost Highway. The song is essentially a memory cast as a dream or a nightmare. There's a diner out on Route 322 in western Pennsylvania. I spent my life there one afternoon, he begins. But then the song moves beyond its parameters as an ominous-sounding reverie. In its long second verse, this woolly bully suddenly becomes a diatribe. We are abandoned, Thomas says flatly. He says everything flatly, with remarkable career-long variations on flatness. He begins a low-key rant about how it's not just people who abandon us, but also all of artistic endeavor. When he castigates museums as, quote, a shell and pea game played by the clever people to bilk the rubes. He insists that, quote, culture is a weapon that's used against us.
Reality is defined by the needs of the media. History's rewritten faster than it can happen. Culture's a weapon that's used against us. Yeah. Culture's a swampland of superstition, ignorance, and abuse. Geography is a language that can't screw up. Land and what we add to it cannot lie. It's also like a meta. Reflect what we see ourselves, or we choose to turn away. Watch it now. Watch it. Watch it.
The rest of Pennsylvania proceeds from the argument and mood set up by that song. It's full of hypnotic, narcotic music, music that takes back the culture that Thomas says is being used against us, as he does on this quite pretty song.
Ah,
When Pere Ubu started out 20 years ago, they sounded like an exceptionally well-oiled, well-drilled noise band from the heartland. Guys cut off from the punk rock in New York and L.A., stuck in Cleveland and determined to make the angry best of it. 20 years later, they sound like men in control of their destinies and full of music that punk rock could only begin to suggest.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan recommends some books for your summer reading. This is Fresh Air. It's not officially summer yet, but book critic Maureen Corrigan has gotten a jump on her vacation adventures as well as her vacation reading.
Last month, I packed my husband and mother into the car and took off for what turned out to be the vacation from hell. Driving around Charleston, South Carolina, one sunny afternoon, we were hit by a very wide station wagon. Nobody was hurt, but our formerly pristine little car now sported a whistling crater on the driver's side. Then my mother began coughing ominously. Doctors in the hospital, where she eventually continued her vacation, were divided over whether she'd picked up pneumonia or Legionnaire's disease. If I hadn't had a good book with me to take my mind off these troubles, I would have done some serious damage to the hotel room minibar. I was reading Birdsong, Sebastian Falk's devastating 1993 novel about World War I. But I have some more recent books to recommend in case your summer getaway also goes haywire. Like Birdsong, Charles Todd's remarkable mystery, Wings of Fire, also deals with the Great War and its aftermath. Scotland Yard Inspector Ian Rutledge is aided on his investigations by the ghost of a young Scottish corporal who fought under his command in France. This detective pairing of the quick and the dead might easily have produced something contrived and cute. But the mournful and highly literary texture of Todd's novel places it in a category closer to Pat Barker's World War I trilogy than to Topper. The mystery here takes place in Cornwall, where members of a distinguished family are dying with suspicious frequency. The prime suspect is a gifted war poet who may also be endowed with a talent for murder. Wings of Fire is Todd's second Ian Rutledge mystery, and I'm devoting my upcoming free time to tracking down the first. Of course, it's a snap to find Sue Grafton's steadily expanding series of alphabet mysteries in almost any bookstore. But the latest, N is for Noose, is a standout because of its eerie atmosphere. Our saucy city girl detective, Kinsey Milhone, is hired to check out the death of a sheriff in the isolated mountain town of Nota Lake. The dinky motel she stays in is straight out of Psycho, and so are many of Nota Lake's residents. As always, Kinsey's feminist-inflected asides about domestic life are as incisive as her detective work. Like me, Kinsey would have saved herself a lot of grief if she'd never left her house. In speaking with strangers, however, Mary Cantwell invokes a time after her divorce when she frequently fled her house to travel to far-off places to escape grief. "I rolled about the world like a billiard ball, looking for a pocket," she recalls. Speaking with Strangers completes the autobiographical trilogy Cantwell began in 1992 with American Girl and continued in 1995 with Manhattan When I Was Young, which described her early married life in Greenwich Village. Here, Cantwell recalls struggling to maintain her editorial career at Mademoiselle and to raise her two daughters on her own. She also ruminates over her long affair with an unnamed famous author and her eccentric friendship with Frederick Exley. But she could write about eating Jell-O, and she'd command my attention. Cantwell makes even the most mundane material extraordinary by the lyric precision and ferocious nostalgia with which she recalls her past. I usually try to avoid sensational critical declarations, but here goes. If you take one recent nonfiction book with you on vacation this summer, make it Bernard Lefkowitz's Our Guys, which is just out in paperback. Our Guys chronicles the notorious 1989 case in which a retarded girl was raped by a bunch of popular high school athletes in upscale Glen Ridge, New Jersey. In the best tradition of social inquisitors like the late, great J. Anthony Lucas, Lefkowitz peels away the glossy surface of this not-so-unusual American suburb. What he finds at the heart of Glen Ridge is a culture in which women learn early that submission is the price of acceptance, and where male achievement, especially athletic achievement, is respected, as one resident puts it, almost to the point of pathology. Our Guys deals with grim material, but you should also know that when it was published in hardback last year, it was deservedly nominated for all sorts of awards, including the Edgar, for Best Nonfiction Work of Suspense. Just be sure that if you do read Our Guys, you're near a beach or a park, some wide open space. You're going to need plenty of room to walk off your anger.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She'll recommend more books for summer reading next week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Kathy Wolf. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. On the next Fresh Air, computer columnists Joshua Quittner and Michelle Slatala discuss their new book on the conflict between Netscape and Microsoft. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.